Okay, so are you ready for this? We're going on a deep dive, and this time it's all about ancient Israelite worship practices.
Ooh, sounds interesting.
It is. Specifically, we're looking at the number and location of altars. It's kind of like think Indiana Jones,
I
meets
think
biblical archaeology.
I like it.
But instead of searching for a lost artifact or something,
Okay.
we are digging into some scholarly discussions
I see it.
about how to understand these ancient texts.
Okay.
And the source material today is a lecture by Dr. Robert Van Noy.
Oh, okay.
And he does a great job at kind of unpacking some of these really complex arguments
Right.
about what different parts of the Bible are telling us about altars.
Well, that's pretty cool because, like, how much do we really know about daily life in ancient
Well,
Israel?
exactly.
Yeah.
And you can learn a lot
Yeah.
just by looking at how they practice their religion.
Uh-huh.
So that leads us to the big question.
Yeah.
Did ancient Israelites have just one central altar for worship? Or could they have multiple altars in different locations?
Oh, that's a good question.
Right. That's like the million-dollar question here.
Yeah.
And it really depends on, how scholars answer that.
Right.
It depends on how they're interpreting certain passages, especially in Deuteronomy.
Makes sense.
So let's start with the traditional view.
Okay.
Right, the traditional view.
Sounds good.
So we have a scholar named Julius Wellhausen,
Okay.
and he proposed this idea that over time, Israelite worship kind of evolved
Okay.
from being really decentralized,
Okay.
with practices happening in various high places,
Right.
to becoming more centralized at a single sanctuary.
So like a progression from like local
A
shrines to
tiny.
like a big grand temple in Jerusalem or something?
Yes, that's exactly it.
Okay.
But as with most things in, biblical scholarship, it's not that simple.
Right.
So we have another scholar, A. Holwarda,
Okay.
and he actually challenges Wellhausen's theory. He's like, wait a minute. Deuteronomy 12 doesn't actually require only one central altar.
Huh.
So think about that for a minute.
Okay.
Wouldn't that make worship really hard for people who lived far away from that central sanctuary?
Yeah, it would be like a huge trek.
Imagine like traveling for days just to offer like a simple sacrifice.
Yeah, to like,
It's very impractical.
Yeah, very impractical.
And that's exactly Howard's point.
Okay.
He says that if you required everyone to journey to one spot
Yeah.
for every single sacrifice,
Yeah.
it would be insanely impractical.
Yeah.
So instead, he suggested Deuteronomy 12 actually supports the idea of multiple altars,
Okay.
each one divinely sanctioned,
Right.
to make worship more accessible
I see.
and to prevent people from being tempted by those nearby Canaanite
Oh,
practices.
that's really
All right.
interesting.
It's like they were trying to find a balance
Yeah.
between staying true to their beliefs and also making worship practical for everybody.
Right, and like realistic too.
Yes, exactly. Now, Dr. Van Noy, he does a great job in his lecture of walking us through Deuteronomy 12 and pointing out some key verses and phrases
Okay.
that support both sides of this argument.
Oh, so what are some examples of those?
Yeah, like give us some examples. Well, on the one hand, you have phrases like utterly destroy all the places,
Right.
which kind of seems like it's pointing towards centralization.
It does, yeah.
On the other hand, you have verses like the place which the Lord your God shall choose,
Okay.
which Howarda argues doesn't necessarily have to be talking about just one singular place.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
So it's like it all depends on how you interpret it.
Exactly. It all boils down to interpretation.
Right.
And then to kind of complicate things even further,
Oh, no.
there's a distinction in these biblical texts
Okay.
between the place and the city.
Oh, okay.
So, for example, for Kings, refers to Jerusalem as the city chosen by God.
Right.
But it doesn't explicitly say that it's the only place for sacrifice.
Oh, okay. I see.
So then, is this where the timing of, when Israel achieved rest
Okay.
after entering Canaan,
Yeah.
this is where the timing becomes important?
Okay.
Because some scholars connect rest with the time of David, while others believe it happened much earlier.
Okay.
So depending on when you think Israel achieved rest,
Right.
it could change how you interpret these verses
It really could. Yeah.
about the place chosen by God.
Right, because you're talking about different timelines.
Yes. We're talking about different timelines, different conclusions about worship practices.
Right.
So just when we think we're starting to, wrap our heads around all this,
Oh boy.
another scholar enters the scene,
Okay, who's that?
M.J. Pohl.
Cole. Okay.
And he agrees with Howarda that Deuteronomy 12 could be read as allowing for multiple alters.
Right.
But he thinks that interpretation is a bit forced.
Oh, really?
I know, right?
So what does he say?
I'm curious to hear how he explains this apparent contradiction.
Yeah, me too.
So Pohl argues that Deuteronomy 12 really focuses primarily on the national level, mandating one central sanctuary, maybe something like the tabernacle.
Right.
But it doesn't really say much about local altars.
Mm.
And he points to other verses in Deuteronomy that seem to suggest that these local altars actually existed.
Give me an example.
Okay, so for example, Deuteronomy 16.21 says, "You shall not plant a grove of any trees near unto the altar of the Lord your God, which you shall make for yourself."
Okay.
So if you're making an altar for yourself,
right,
that implies that you're allowed to build altars outside the central sanctuary.
Right, so that kind of pokes a hole in that first theory.
Exactly.
Right.
Because the first theory was making these faulty comparisons.
Yeah.
So Pohl's key insight is that Exodus, like Deuteronomy, addresses both national and local levels of worship.
I see.
So he's saying that Wellhausen's theory kind of falls apart because it's comparing apples to oranges.
Yeah, comparing two different things.
Exactly.
Okay.
So now we've got these two major interpretations.
Right.
One that's focusing on practicality and the other one on this distinction between national and local worship.
Yeah.
And the text itself seems to be open to both.
Wow.
What else do we need to consider when we're unpacking this debate?
But we can't forget about the high places, you know,
right,
in Israelite worship.
Okay.
And this is where it gets even more interesting, because there's a big debate about whether all high places were considered bad.
Okay.
Or if it just depended on what kind of worship was happening there.
Yeah, because like we always assume that, you know, high places are associated with
like pagan
practices. But maybe it's more complicated than that.
Yeah, it's not quite so simple.
Okay.
Dr. Vannoy reminds us about this danger of syncretism.
Oh, right.
Which is the blending of Israelite beliefs with Canaanite practices at these high places.
Yeah.
And this might explain why some kings destroyed them.
Right. They were trying to purify worship.
Exactly.
Okay. So that makes sense, especially because, you know, in ancient Israel, they were surrounded by all these different cultures with different beliefs.
Yeah.
So it must have been like this constant struggle to maintain their own religious identity.
Absolutely a challenge.
Now, to make things even more complicated.
Oh, I don't like when it gets more complicated.
There's this seemingly contradictory detail about King Asa.
Okay.
And what he did with high places.
What did he do?
So one book says that he didn't remove them.
Okay.
And another one says that he did.
Wait, how is that possible?
Right. It sounds really confusing.
Yeah. How can both be true?
So one possible explanation for this is that Asa might have destroyed high places that were dedicated to foreign gods.
Okay.
But left those that were dedicated to Yahweh intact.
So it's not a black and white situation.
No.
Yeah.
Not at all. It all comes down to, you know, context.
Yeah.
And careful writing.
Careful reading.
Which really emphasizes the importance of critical thinking.
Right.
And digging deeper.
Yeah.
Especially when you're studying these ancient religious texts.
Yeah, those are tricky.
So to kind of recap what we've learned so far.
Okay.
The debate about the number and location of altars in ancient Israel really hinges on how we interpret these specific biblical texts.
Right.
Particularly Deuteronomy 12.
Okay.
And there's evidence to support both the idea of a single central sanctuary.
Right.
And the idea of the existence of multiple local altars.
Yeah.
And then you throw in this whole discussion about high places.
Right.
It adds like a whole other layer of complexity.
It really does. Yeah.
And it's fascinating because, you know, something as specific as the location of altars can open up this window into a much broader understanding of ancient Israelite society.
It really can.
And their religious beliefs.
Yeah. Makes you think, doesn't it?
It does. It makes you wonder, like, how do these ancient debates connect to our own lives today?
That's a great question.
So I think we should take a break right here.
Okay.
Let our listener process all this information.
Yeah.
And when we come back, we'll explore even more intriguing aspects of this debate.
Okay. Sounds good.
Including, you know, the economic and social implications.
Oh, wow.
Of centralized versus decentralized worship.
Okay. I'm ready.
Stay tuned.
All right.
Welcome back to our deep dive.
We're back.
We've been unpacking this debate about the number and location of altars in ancient Israel.
Right.
And we've already, like, uncovered some pretty fascinating insights.
We have.
And I don't know if you remember.
Okay.
But we talked about King Josiah.
Yes.
And his centralization of worship in Jerusalem.
Yes.
And it made me wonder, like, were there other factors besides, like, religious zeal driving those decisions?
Yeah, that's a great question.
Like, was there something else going on?
Well, it's a valid question, and scholar Richard Nelson, he's actually explored this idea.
Okay.
And he argues that Josiah's reforms might have been motivated, at least in part, by a desire to consolidate his power and legitimize his reign.
So using religion as a tool for political gain.
Exactly.
Which is something we see throughout history.
Oh, yeah, all the time.
Right.
Yeah.
It's not a new thing.
Not a new thing.
So Nelson suggests that by establishing Jerusalem as the only authorized place of worship, Josiah could strengthen his claim to be the sole legitimate ruler of Israel.
Oh, that's interesting.
Right.
Yeah, it makes you think about how intertwined religion and politics really are.
Exactly, and it always has been.
Yeah, even in ancient society.
Yeah. So not only would that be a spiritual change, but like a power shift too.
Totally. Yeah, he'd have more control over the resources and the religious practices and everything.
And this is a great example of how, you know, looking beyond those like surface level explanations can give us like a deeper understanding of history.
Totally agree.
Now let's dive into another fascinating concept.
Okay, hit me.
Okay, so it's closely tied to this whole debate.
Okay.
The idea of cultic purity.
Okay, cultic purity.
In ancient Israel.
So what does cultic purity mean?
Okay, so essentially it's about maintaining a state of ritual cleanliness.
Okay.
And separation from anything considered like impure or profane.
Okay.
So think of it as like a set of rules and practices designed to ensure that worship is conducted in a way that is pleasing to God.
So is it just about like physical cleanliness or is it?
It's more than that.
Okay.
It's like it encompasses everything from diet and hygiene to interactions with foreigners.
Okay.
All sorts of things could affect your ritual purity.
It sounds pretty demanding.
It was.
Okay.
It was very strict. But maintaining cultic purity was seen as essential for maintaining a right relationship with God and ensuring the well-being of the whole community.
I can see how that would have a big impact on daily life.
Yeah, not just special religious occasions.
Right.
It permeated every aspect of Israelite society.
Right.
So how does this concept of cultic purity relate to our discussion about altars and high places?
I was just thinking that.
It seems like they would be connected.
It seems like they would, yeah.
Okay, so one argument is that centralizing worship in Jerusalem was a way to enforce a greater cultic purity.
Right.
So by having a single sanctuary, it would make it easier to kind of control and regulate those religious practices.
Right, because everyone's in one place.
But wouldn't that also make worship less accessible for the people who lived far away from Jerusalem?
Right. And what would that lead them to do?
Right.
Yeah.
And wouldn't that potentially lead them to create their own altars and practices, which could lead to syncretism?
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
So some scholars actually argue that having multiple altars might have actually facilitated cultic purity by giving people readily accessible places to offer sacrifices and perform those rituals according to the proper guidelines.
Oh, I see.
Right.
So it's like centralized control versus decentralized accessibility.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And this whole debate about cultic purity really highlights how complex it is to interpret ancient religious practices.
Right.
There's rarely a simple answer.
Never a simple answer.
And it reminds me of how we were talking about the different interpretation of the same biblical text.
Right.
There are often multiple perspectives that can coexist.
Yeah.
Even when they seem to contradict each other.
Absolutely.
And to illustrate this point, I think it's helpful to look at a specific example.
Okay.
The biblical account of the golden calf incident.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Do you remember that story?
Yeah, kind of refresh memory.
So Moses goes up Mount Sinai to get those Ten Commandments.
Yeah.
And while he's gone, the Israelites get impatient.
Yeah, they're like, where is he?
And they decide to make their own god.
Right, the golden calf.
The goldie calf.
And they have a party.
Yeah, big party.
Yeah, lots of revelry.
Revelry and idol worship.
Yeah, they went all out.
And this incident is often interpreted as like a blatant violation of cultic purity.
Right.
This complete disregard for the commandment against idolatry.
Yeah, seems like a straightforward cautionary tale. Right, like, you better follow those laws.
Follow God's laws.
Yeah.
But some scholars offer a different interpretation.
Oh, really?
They suggest that the golden calf wasn't actually meant to replace Yahweh.
Okay.
But rather to symbolize his presence.
So like a physical representation.
Yes. Like a physical representation of their faith.
Okay.
Not a rejection of it. And there's actually evidence for this in the text itself.
Oh, okay.
So the Israelites, they cry out, "These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt."
Okay.
Which implies that they still saw Yahweh.
Yeah.
As their liberator.
Right. So it makes you question their intentions.
Right. Were they actually rejecting God?
Right.
Or were they just trying to represent him in a way that they understood?
Yeah.
So even a story as well known as the Golden Calf incident can be open to different interpretations.
Yeah.
Depending on, you know, the historical context, the cultural practices, all these different factors.
Right. It's all about looking beyond the surface.
Exactly.
Digging deeper.
Digging deeper.
Yeah.
But why should our listener care about these ancient debates about cultic purity?
That's a great question.
Like, what relevance does this have for us today?
Right.
In the 21st century?
Well, I think for starters, it encourages us to reflect on our own ideas about purity and how they might be shaping our own values and behaviors. Mm. I mean, we all have things that we consider sacred or profane, and we make choices every day based on those beliefs.
It's like asking ourselves, what do we consider sacred?
Yeah.
What are the things we try to keep separate?
Uh-huh.
And why?
Exactly. Good questions.
Right.
And these questions can lead to a deeper understanding of our own faith and like a greater appreciation for the different ways that people throughout history have tried to connect with the divine.
Right. It's a reminder that like the human search for meaning and purpose, it's a universal experience.
Yeah, we all do it.
Even if like the expressions of that search vary across time and cultures, it's all about that connection.
Yeah.
But there's another important takeaway here.
Okay, what's that?
This whole exploration of cultic purity really highlights how important critical thinking is.
Yes.
And avoiding hasty judgments.
Right. We've got to be willing to consider those multiple perspectives.
Especially when we're studying history and religion.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a reminder to approach complex issues with empathy and an open mind.
For sure.
So before we move on to the final part.
Okay.
Our deep dive.
Yeah.
I want to leave our listener with something to ponder.
Sure.
How do our modern ideas about purity and impurity compare to those of ancient Israel?
That's a good one.
And what does that tell us about how cultural norms and religious beliefs evolve over time?
That is a fantastic question to consider.
I know, right?
Yeah.
We've covered a lot of ground today.
A lot of ground.
But there's still so much more to explore.
So much more.
So when we come back,
we'll
wrap up our exploration
of
ancient Israelite worship practices.
Okay.
And we'll discuss what lasting lessons we can learn from these ancient debates.
All right. Sounds good. I'm ready.
Stay tuned. Welcome back to our deep dive. It's amazing how much we've learned, you know, just by focusing on this one aspect of ancient Israelite worship practices.
It is, isn't it?
The altars.
Yeah. You know, it really shows you how those little details can unlock this deeper understanding of a whole culture.
And we've, you know, we've explored different interpretations of biblical text. We've talked about cultic purity, even the political dimensions of religious practices.
Mm-hmm.
It's been like...
like peeling back layers of an onion.
Yes.
Like an onion.
More and more complex.
More and more complex with every layer.
Yeah.
So as we wrap up our deep dive,
I'm
curious, what are your thoughts on the lasting legacy of these ancient practices?
Oh, that's a good question.
Like, what can they teach us about faith and community?
Yeah.
And even the search for meaning in today's world?
Well, you know, I think one of the key takeaways from all this is that religious practices aren't static.
Right.
They evolve.
They evolve.
They adapt over time. They respond to changing circumstances and cultural influences.
So it's not just about what happened, you know, thousands of years ago.
Right.
It's about understanding how those ancient practices are shaping how we think about faith today.
Exactly. Think about, you know, that whole debate surrounding the number and location of altars in ancient Israel.
Mm-hmm.
That shows us that even something as basic as worship can be interpreted in multiple ways.
It can. And that's such an important lesson for us today.
It is.
As we're navigating this world of, you know, diverse beliefs and practices.
Right. So many different faiths and ideas.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it reminds us that we need to approach these religious discussions with humility.
Absolutely.
Recognizing that there isn't always one right answer.
Not always.
So flexibility and understanding are key.
Very key.
What else can we learn from these ancient Israelites?
Well, I think another enduring legacy of their worship practices is the emphasis on community.
You know, we saw how those religious festivals and sacrifices brought people together.
Yes.
They fostered the sense of shared identity and purpose.
It wasn't just about individual piety.
Right.
It was about being part of something larger than yourself.
Yeah. And that sense of belonging is so essential.
Yes.
For us today.
It is.
You know, it's just as essential as it was back then.
It provides that sense of support.
Yes.
Connection.
Uh-huh.
Meaning.
Absolutely.
Especially in times of need.
Especially in times of need.
It's like a safety net.
Yeah.
You know, woven from shared beliefs and traditions.
That's a beautiful way to put it.
And experiences.
Yeah.
A great example of this is the Passover Seder.
Oh, yeah. Good one.
Right.
Yeah.
That ritual meal that's observed on the eve of Passover.
Yeah. I love that story.
And the story itself is so powerful.
It is.
Right. Commemorating the Israelites' liberation from slavery in Egypt.
Freedom, hope, resilience.
Yes. And the cedar brings that story to life.
He does.
In a very tangible way.
It does.
Right.
Yeah.
Families gather together.
Uh-huh.
They retell the story of the Exodus.
Right.
They eat symbolic foods.
Uh-huh.
And they reflect on the meaning of freedom and redemption.
And it connects the past to the present.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's not just about remembering the past.
Right.
It's about connecting it to the present.
Yeah. Finding that relevance for today.
Finding relevance for our own lives.
I love that.
And it's a beautiful example of how, you know, religious practices can transmit values and traditions across generations.
Amazing, isn't it?
It is strengthening family bonds, reinforcing cultural identity.
Yeah.
So these ancient rituals can still hold meaning.
Absolutely.
For us in the 21st century.
Deep meaning.
Deep meaning.
Yes.
So as we wrap up, it boils down to those two key points.
Okay.
Being open to multiple perspectives.
Yeah.
Yes. And the power of community.
Community.
Which are timeless values.
Absolutely.
Just as relevant today as they were thousands of years ago.
I agree.
So what final thought
would
you leave with our listener?
What aspects of your own faith or spiritual practice resonate with the themes that we've explored today?
Okay.
Do you see echoes of these ancient Israelite beliefs in your own life?
Okay.
How does your faith connect you to a larger community?
Uh-huh.
And how do you navigate the complexities of faith in a world full of diverse beliefs?
Those are great questions to think about.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've only scratched the surface of this topic.
We have.
But hopefully this deep dive has sparked some new insights.
Some new insights.
And new perspectives.
Yeah, I think so.
So thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
On this journey into the world of ancient Israelite worship.
It's been fun.
It has.
Yeah.
Until next time.
Until next time.
Keep exploring.
Keep exploring.
Keep questioning.
Keep cleansing. Seeking. And keep seeking.
And remember.
Yeah.
The past is never truly past.
That's true.
It lives on.
Yeah.
In the stories we tell.
Uh-huh.
The traditions we uphold.
Right.
And the lessons we learn.
The lessons we learn.
Thanks for diving deep with us.